Hi, I'm Chris Carter, creator of The X-Files, and you're listening to The X-Cast.
Welcome everybody to The X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host, and this is the first official episode of the show after our primer, in which we're talking about an episode itself. So if you consider the primer the pilot, this is episode one, although today we are going to be featuring a certain pilot, but with me, to start off with, before we get to that, is my co-host for the day. Please welcome Lee Howard.
Hello, Tony. Thank you for having me on for your mammoth undertaking. It's my pleasure to be here, especially as we're getting to talk about, the pilot episode of obviously what has become a very widely known and influential show, I guess, on popular culture, The X-Files.
Indeed. It is a mammoth undertaking. You're absolutely right. So, yeah, we'll see how we go. And it will be fun to actually examine each episode of the show. And, if after 5 years we manage to make it to the end, which will probably take about 5 years, we'll look back on this with some humour. So to begin, before we actually launch into the meat and potatoes of the episode, I'm going to ask Lee five little trigger questions, which ask... this isn't the difficult bit. This is the quiz later, where you. These are just five little questions, just to get the juices flowing of conversation, really, about the X-Files. So, no pressure on these. If you're not sure or you don't know, it's fine. But start off with, when did you first watch or discover the X-Files?
Right. Okay. Now, I may be getting the factual chronology incorrect, but I think like most. I don't know, cultural products that you have an affection for, you've got your own history with them, whether that actually relates to the reality of it or not. So I'm not entirely sure how I was introduced to it, whether it was on cable television broadcast or whether it was actually the terrestrial broadcast in the UK. Mm. So I'm not entirely clear on the year, because it aired in the US in 93, didn't it?
That's right.
The first season, yeah. So it was around the first season, and around that particular time, actually, my parents had separated and we'd actually moved to another area. So it was like a very kind of pivotal moment for me in my own personal life. And I can kind of remember, in amongst all that turmoil, you get these strange sort of memories. It can be anything that kind of like unifies the family in some way. And I can distinctly remember there started to be, because we were beginning to get US TV shows on, broadcast TV in the UK. There started to be like these shows that I could, that bridged the gap, I guess, between myself and my mum. So like things that we could watch and share together. We had already built up a regular routine of kind of like renting VHS tapes. And like, I've got my love of film to really thank my mum for, in the sense that it was like something we did together with my sister. And as I say, The X-Files, and I think around the similar sort of time, My So-Called Life, the TV show with Claire Danes.
Oh, shit.
At high school. Yeah, it seemed to be those shows were just ones that really spoke to, the differing generations, but in a way that it can be enjoyed by both. Like, so with My So-Called Life, although that the protagonist is someone who was of a similar age to me at the time when I was watching it, a lot of the show is spent exploring her relationship with her parents. Now, I obviously didn't appreciate it at the time for what it was doing in a kind of quite a groundbreaking way, but that really is a show that does play to multiple audiences of different ages. And The X-Files was kind of genre enough to really engage me, because I was even then like a budding sort of horror and sci-fi fan. But it was also, I think, that because the focus is the characterizations that obviously had a pull for like my mum being an adult watching it with us. And also it's the whole kind of spin on the crime sort of the genre of film. And it was really groundbreaking. I remember watching Silence of the Lambs probably.
Yeah.
Around the same time, and instantly kind of like being fascinated and falling in love with Jodie Foster's Clarice Starling. Like, even to this day, I think you've got Clarice Starling, Dana Scully, and possibly in a different way, Sarah Connor from the Terminator sequel, that they are really kind of iconic images of female protagonists in like film and TV that have sort of stayed with me. And I think it all just kind of like got mixed up amongst that particular period of my life. So although I've gone away from the X-Files, and I don't think I even saw it every episode even back then, I think it was always something I've dipped in and out of. It's just obviously added resonance for me over time. I think because of, like, you know, those personal factors, but also because of the certain things that the show was doing, even though it might not be necessarily championed all of the time, I think it's really crucial that what happened sort of in American film and TV when they had the introduction of those types of characters. I think they are just so iconic, and they were really influential, I think, in some of the writing and the whole kind of like forensic aspect of, you know, where not necessarily sci-fi would go, but the whole kind of serial killer police procedural genre would go after Silence of the Lambs.
I think Silence of the Lambs is a definite strong inspiration for the X-Files, and certainly for Dana Scully. I think that's, you can see the DNA there, definitely. That's really interesting. Yeah, cool. Okay. From the episodes you have seen then, or you remember seeing, what is your favourite one? What one stood out for you?
God, I think a lot of it's kind of like got messed up in my mind, and like part of wanting to be a very small part of your show, and what I'm really keen to listen to is to be able to go back and like watch it and sort of, I think it will spark memories for me as I start watching the episodes again, because I haven't gone back and watched the X-Files for literally decades. So it's very, very murky. But I mean, even I was really amazed going through your schedule, because you've already booked in, you know, guests, haven't you, for different shows and different episodes. I was amazed that I always refer to him as the guy that could stretch, you know. I was really surprised to find that was an early episode in season one, because that's definitely one that has stayed with me. So what's the name of that episode? Do you know it? The guy that can stretch himself to fit through different spaces?
That would be Squeeze.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Eugene Victor Toombs, which...
I remember him now from like things like The Green Mile, because he was very memorable in that film. So that was definitely one that I think would have really appealed when I watched it when I was younger, because it's just on that... It's not as extreme as what people would get away with on things like HBO now, but at the time, it felt like it did have some of that edginess to it. There was just like a wrinkle of texture to thrill the horror fan. So that I can remember that episode leaving an impression on me, because it did get under my skin. But yeah, I never would have guessed that was from like the very first season, and it was only like half a dozen episodes in. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was the third episode, and it's the original Monster of the Week, so to speak, episode.
Of course, because again, this show, I don't know if it was the first one, but the X-Files was very much key in kind of promoting that idea of the Freak of the Week that would then become like a stock trade of loads of shows. I'm thinking like Smallville used to do it all the time. So, and then obviously you've got that other aspect of the show, which is like the concurrent and through line of this kind of main story arc, which again now has been really embraced and is ultimately how a lot of, you know, some shows now dispense with the Freak of the Week completely, and they're just all about, you know, this continuous arc over, you know, a certain number of episodes. So again, kind of the X-Files was doing both things at a time where it wasn't necessarily kind of cliche.
Absolutely, yeah. And Squeeze is a great example of that, definitely. Off the back of that, again, this might be quite tricky for you to answer, okay, given you haven't seen the show in a while, but did you have a particular favourite season overall, or a general run of the show where you thought this is where it's really good?
God, again, because I don't think I saw every episode of every season at the time. It's kind of, I don't have a clear, because we're going back to the time where these were like aired and then that was it. Like, they weren't out on DVD. It was before the advent of DVD. They weren't even on VHS, I don't think, in seasons. So I didn't have... It's not like now you can catalogue it and it can really quickly identify what show is in each season. But I think it was wherever we were building up to the reveal of the, like, the, you know, one of the main themes is the whole idea of like the conspiracy and the potential of the, you know, the government being in league or in some way knowing about the aliens and what they've done. I think there was a season where we were building up and it was almost promising for that to be... tied up or resolved in some way. Is that season five? Is this around the time that the movies came out?
Yeah, roughly season five, season six, right, time, yeah, was when that was all starting to wrap up, really.
So I would say the early episodes I saw definitely was what, you know, what I felt it was a great kind of fresh show. And then I was really keen to see where it would end up. But from memory, and again, this is going to be one of my particular pleasures, because obviously you're much more well-versed in the mythos of the X-Files and have probably got much more recent work in memory of the shows, whereas for me, I'm going to kind of be rediscovering it all again, which is going to be fantastic having you as the guide and your guests along the way as I can watch episodes as you're recording the shows and releasing them. But I vaguely remember being quite disappointed with how that was resolved, and I wasn't particularly keen on the movies. Now, again, I'll be keen to go back to them within the context of your podcast to reevaluate them. But I think I felt sort of let down or sort of hard done by. And I think it was one of those early examples, again, of where you commit to a show, you get really invested in it, but it somehow doesn't ever meet your expectations, and that can kind of like make you need to step away. And to be honest, I'm not even sure I've seen past. I mean, if you're saying that's season 5, season 6, I don't think I've even watched past that. So I'd be very surprised when we get to the later seasons, like 7 to 9, whether I've got any memory of where it went from there.
Well, it becomes a little bit of a different show in the last couple of seasons. And the mythology and the kind of all, it's part of a bigger whole, but it does morph a little bit. So once you get from out of season 6, it does start to slightly change. So yeah, I think a lot of people aren't as familiar with the last 2 or 3 seasons, because by then, and it was even the ratings will back this up, a lot of people had stopped watching, to be quite honest, by then. A bit like what happened with Lost and other shows like that, where a lot of people are familiar with the first few seasons a lot, and they can reel off sort of, oh, that's the one with what's his name? Well, that's the one with the shape-changing mutant guy. But they can't say, you know, the later episodes what they were about. So that's going to be interesting for people to go back, I think, and see those. But yeah, okay. Last little question then before we crack on. Who would you say your favourite character is from the show?
Well, it's probably going to be very similar to like a lot of people, and something I've already alluded to. It would definitely be like Dana Scully. As much as I think Mulder's great, and we'll get onto that in the context of the pilot. I mean, that's one of the real keys of the show, that the kind of central relationship or the central kind of characterizations were so evident, like even from so early on. But no, definitely Dana Scully, because I would say, it's hard to say whose story is the X-Files, but I think in many ways, in the way possibly I was watching it, and I think we're probably aligned to her deliberately by the scripts and the direction, because we're kind of discovering this whole world of the paranormal. You know, we might have heard of it, but we're meant to kind of partially be the skeptic. Although, to be honest, it's almost the inverse. I think I was more willing to believe all of it when I first saw the show, and now as an adult rewatching it, I'm much more of a skeptic. But yeah, no, it's got to be Dana Scully for the reasons, you know, aligning her with Clarice Starling again. I just found that really fascinating. Again, I don't know if I wanted to get deep about it. You know, my father was like absent. I was like, I had an elder sister, and I was being raised by my mum. So I've got a really kind of matriarchal family unit. So I don't know whether it's just that I'm instinctively more interested in kind of female protagonists, but that's kind of like the lens that I chose to see the show through. And I just think they do, although some of it now is really heavy-handed about, you know, how she's obviously chose to keep emotions, you know, she's detached and she's had to focus on her career, and somehow that's at the expense of her love life. You know, I think some of it now is really on the nose, the way they're trying to pick that in certain episodes, but for the time, that sort of shorthand worked, and it was in service of trying to do something quite positive. You know, I think sometimes you can view some of the stereotypical aspects of the character in a reductive way now, but I don't think that was ever the intention. I think it was always meant to be a very positive and alternative portrayal at that time of, she's every much the lead as, David Duchovny.
And I think the crucial thing is that when you said, you know, whose show is it? I think it's both their show. I think it's both their story. Whenever one of them wasn't there, and there were periods in the show where one of them wasn't there, it didn't quite feel the same. And I think that's the whole point of why, when the X-Files did try and become a little bit of something else about the actual idea, and about which we'll get into a long, long way down the road, people went, well, no, because it's Mulder and Scully we want. It's about Mulder and Scully. And that's why we now have a revival coming up, which is about those two as much as it is about the actual idea of UFOs and aliens and myth and conspiracy. Okay, so thanks for that, Lee. We're going to move from talking about briefly the future right back to the past, to the very beginning where it all began. We're going to talk about the pilot. The pilot episode of The X-Files then, which was written, of course, by Chris Carter, who created the show, and was directed by Robert Mandel, who didn't go on to direct particularly many more episodes, I believe, of the show. But in fact, he didn't. I'm just checking. He didn't actually direct anything else. And a lot of the directors for the X-Files actually went on and directed lots more episodes. Robert Mandel only ever did the pilot. So the plot begins, of course, with the teaser, which is a traditional standard thing for the X-Files. Although in this episode, this is the only one of the entire series which doesn't have any regular opening credit sequences. That's not until the next episode, Deep Throat, that we actually see the quite iconic credit sequence, which I think that was done specifically to create a kind of unsettling mood, because it does have the notice, the following story is inspired by actual documented accounts, which does make you think, maybe this is real, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, but that was also, you know, one of the joys, wasn't it, about the X-Files at that time, that it covered certain, aspects that are on the fringe of sort of the public consciousness. I don't remember having like a really clear familiarity with the Men in Black and Area 51 and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. I think, if anything, it was the X-Files that either spurred people on to find out more about that or brought it up more in kind of like general conversation, you know. So for me, yeah, a lot of that was all kind of fresh and new, and part of the fun of suspending disbelief is going along with it. I mean, I think you're right in the sense that it's actually quite disconcerting going back and watching the pilot and not having the iconic opening credits of music, and the whole imagery of the girl running through a forest at night really just instantly reminded me of other things. So like for Bridleson, the original version of The Killing, that begins, like every episode they start with showing the kidnapped girl running through the forest at night, so similarly framed. And also you get that mysterious light, don't you, in the forest setting, and it's got like silhouette become invisible, and it just kind of shouts E.T., you know, Spielberg. I mean, yes, and there's like a little name check for Spielberg later on. So it's kind of a clear way that they're showing immediately their kind of inspirations, but also, you know, it's the whole cold open idea and some of the other things that the show does that would go on to kind of influence even modern TV. So.
Absolutely. I think they were spearheading a bit there. Chris Carter did say that the episode was, it's an amalgam of bits and pieces of stories and information that I gathered by reading about alien abduction. So he's pieced together various different sources for the actual overarching story, which is obviously this class of students who are being seemingly abducted by unknown forces. But as an opening, it's quite unsettling and leaves you a little bit on edge. And it's, I think the big thing to remember is, of course, that TV shows didn't really do any of this. And obviously we've talked a bit about this in the primer last week, but it's one of those things that TV shows just didn't really do. There wasn't many shows around the early 90s that were scaring people. And I think that's one of the big things that Chris Carter wanted to do. You know, he wanted to scare people. But I think, imagine watching that like in the early 90s when it first, I mean, not even I did that, you know, I was a couple of years afterwards when I first went and rediscovered them. But imagine watching that right when it premiered. Nobody knew what it was.
Yeah, then on the tails of this, you're going to get shows like Twin Peaks. And although I would say there's a lot of massive differences between the two, they do share some kind of kinship in pushing the envelope and kind of going into showing another side, I guess, of like American life. And they even like the 4:3 TV framing and the sort of softness and almost noise of the image really kind of like recall Twin Peaks to me in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, Twin Peaks was earlier, actually.
Oh, right, okay.
I think Twin Peaks was 91, because David Duchovny was in Twin Peaks and he played a transvestite,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, you're right.
So I think that was, like you said earlier, like Silence of the Lambs and Thomas Harris, I think Twin Peaks was also an inspiration for Chris Carter. So definitely, you can definitely see that DNA again. Obviously then, after the cold open, as you say, we're off into meeting our characters. And it's interesting how Scully is the first character we see. And I think that's a good intentional thing, because it's showing that in many respects the pilot is from her point of view, isn't it, as opposed to Mulder's.
Yeah, and it really calls back Silence of the Lambs and how you're introduced to Clarice Starling, where you get like the lone female almost having to navigate her way through like a really masculine patriarchal world. So in Silence of the Lambs it was more extended, but in here you get a condensed version of her, you know, walking through the office where, you know, there's lots of busy men doing their work, and she's kind of like, you know, not an outsider, but she is, isn't she? Like, she is an outsider. She's been invited there for the first time. And you just, you know, get a little wrinkle of that subtext, you know, of her, you know, being up against it. And also the whole idea that we as the viewer with her is are taken down to meet, you know, there's almost like a, there's a mystique, isn't there, about, you know, Spooky Mulder and what's he going to be like. And I don't want to jump ahead because you'll obviously get to it, but I love the way, and one of the great things about the X-Files as well is that they have a bit of humour. So you're building up for it to being, wow, who are we going to go and meet? Is it going to be like this Hannibal Lecter character? Whereas it's kind of like diffused immediately, where it's this very kind of like good-looking, affable, you know, FBI agent, where he says the FBI is most unwanted, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just...
Great first line. Yeah, exactly. And it's that whole thing of it's building up the mythos of who he is before we even meet him, Mulder. And you know, it goes...
The whole idea of misrepresentation, you're right, that's really important, yeah.
It's true, it's establishing him before we meet him, which is a really interesting way of doing it. I always think one of the big, obviously, other inspirations to this that Chris Carter has got on record as saying, I'm sure we will definitely talk about over the time of the show, is Sherlock Holmes and Watson. And I think there's a massive similarity in many respects there too, because... You know, a lot of the original Conan Doyle stories were very much from Watson's point of view, and establishing Holmes as the mythos and more than just a guy. And obviously Mulder is a very much a modern Sherlock Holmes in many respects. So it's, again, there's lots of...
He's always got the more modern eccentricities and, and the vices, which they're not necessarily got to in this episode, but that's always...
But they're definitely coming. It's interesting, actually, though, just the scene where... Scully does go to the office of the FBI. There was a few interesting changes in the original draft for this.
Okay. Right.
There were more scenes before she gets to the office. So the first time we were going to meet her was when she was going to be at the FBI Academy in Quantico teaching a group of trainees about the physiology of homicide, which would have really been a lot, the very Silence of the Lambs, wouldn't it? Having her there. And then she gets a call saying you need to contact an agent in the FBI, and then she gets to reception. And there's another agent there called Lake Drazen, who wasn't even in the show in the end, who then takes her up to see Section Chief Blevins, who obviously, you know, is there.
Wow. I wonder whether there was even a scene then of her getting in a lift and it all being surrounded by tall men and her being dwarfed in the middle. Silence of the Lambs.
It could have been. Could well have been.
I love all how they also do the, is it like the date or the location captioning?
Yes.
I can remember like now when you go back, there's actually elements that don't hold up and seem really kind of hokey and cliche. You know, some of the effects work, looks a bit cheap and a bit naff now, but, you know, he obviously didn't at the time. And also, we're so used to seeing that kind of time stamping and shows moving around a lot in location and geography. Whereas for me watching it, I can remember... Definitely, even, you know, many years ago now, feeling that felt very new and modern.
Mm.
You know, that was something that I hadn't seen, like a lot of text scroll, and we are going to move around a lot in, you know, in one country, and it's going to be different environments. So it's going to be like small town America, but we're also going to be, you know, at the FBI headquarters, just seeing that kind of flash up Washington, D.C., that was still like, you know, a modern and new kind of getting a glimpse into an unseen world in a way. I mean, you know, every show is like that now, but, you know, there was no CSI and all of that stuff at this
right time. Definitely. And it was to that extent a modern element, and it's one of those iconic things that stuck with the show, really, the text coming up, you know. And it was a great thing that they obviously kept throughout the entire run, and I've no doubt that'll be back in the new series. Another key point to the meeting, obviously, is that this is the first time we see the cigarette smoking man.
Oh, I couldn't believe he was in that. Yeah, I'd totally forgotten that he was in the first episode.
Now, the crucial thing is with this, that when this guy isn't the smoking man at this point in many respects. They had William B. Davis, who obviously plays the smoking man, come in as pretty much an extra, even though he was quite in Canada, he was quite a talented theatre director and teacher, and he has been for a long time. But he came in pretty much as an extra, because obviously they shot the show in Vancouver, so it's all around there. And in the end, it was the way he performs, even saying nothing, and he doesn't speak until I think it's Tombs, like almost towards the end of season one, and he's in it a few times. But it's almost like they retroactively had the character there. But now when you look back and you see that what that character is and how crucial he is to the show, it's fascinating to look back and see that obviously he was interested in all this right from the very beginning. So it's But obviously they didn't have the character as he was in mind at that point.
Yeah, it's just one of those like happy accidents. It's fantastic when those kind of things can happen, particularly now, like you're saying, that it fits the continuity so well, because he kind of dovetails like his presence, although it's unspoken. He's like, always watching, and clearly at the end, his action dovetails this particular pilot episode, doesn't it? Where
definitely.
We get the reveal, and again, like a real clear nod to Spielberg in the in the Pentagon Library, that's really reminiscent of where all the secrets get hidden in the Indiana Jones.
Yeah, very Raiders of the Lost Ark, yeah, at the end. Obviously, then we go into the first meeting between Mulder and Scully, which you briefly mentioned, which is definitely one of the most iconic scenes of the entire show, and I think really well written.
Yeah, definitely. This whole pilot, I think, is... I mean, it doesn't have the budget and the marketing behind it, and the kind of the ratings impact that something like the Lost pilot did.
Mm.
But I think in terms of its success in setting up and introducing what the series is going to be about, it is almost flawless in a way. I mean, and I think the writing, like you've said, is so key to that. I was amazed watching it again for this episode. They managed to finesse the natural kind of exposition, like in any pilot, you have a lot of exposition dialogue and a lot of almost clunky writing, whereas they were able to retain a natural flow of the conversations. Like, I felt the drip feed of information of what we needed to know to kind of get up to speed was managed really well, so it came off as authentic.
It's a testament to the actors as well, because as we talked about in the primer, it took them quite a while, I think, to actually get to the point where Fox were happy with, especially Gillian Anderson in the role. And it's interesting how they have chemistry immediately. You very rarely find that in TV shows, and it's probably one of the reasons that a lot of TV shows don't work or are cancelled, because the characters and the actors just don't have that fizz. But these two, they have the most amazing chemistry from the moment they speak to each other, and it's everything that is there for the next, well, as it's turned out, the next 25 years of X-Files is in that scene, really. I mean,
And obviously the later scene that they have together, which is obviously more kind of dramatic and more intimate. But I think that's the crucial thing, where some shows you can tell the people, like the actors playing the roles, although obviously there's a division between real life, the on-screen life and off-screen life, but the fact is you can tell sometimes when you watch something that there is a natural physical attraction between cast members, and that can give the show the energy and the chemistry. And then there's others that the writing is like what really kind of drives it. And I think they struck gold here because they've got both like it. So it's not just, oh, they're attracted to one another and, it's going to be like the whole kind of romantic angle. It's more their... it's just as equally their kind of philosophies or their clash of ideologies, and the whole way that at the beginning, and again, it's something I just kind of forgotten, really, is how much Dana had been almost recruited as like a spy. I mean, it's really kind of overtly talked about in this pilot, but I think somehow I kind of sublimated that rivalry. It was like an instant, they were set up almost to be antagonists of one another and not get on. But that even within this pilot, the battleground has changed and shifted, and you can see that she's going to be more an ally, although she's not going to, as it goes on, she more kind of almost blindly follows him in a sense. And she's still like, she's going to have equal weight to him, and it's going to be something they're going to constantly have to talk and discuss over, and and they're going to, their sympathy is going to shift. But the fact is, they were almost intended as enemies.
Definitely.
But it's through like their personalities and the way that the chemistry between the two, that it doesn't, they have like a mutual respect of one another and an interest, don't they? A genuine intrigue. And I think that really mirrors us as the viewer, because like we're interested in them.
I think you're absolutely spot on. I think that's absolutely true, because people do forget that she was originally sent down there to, debunk his work. And it's towards the end of season four and the beginning of season five that a lot of this pilot is almost a sequel to this pilot in many respects, because a lot of that is contextualized years later as part of the actual mythology and the story, and he even brings back certain characters from the pilot who we hadn't really seen since this episode, or roughly thereabouts. But over the course, if this was a modern TV show, the whole arc of Scully being a spy would have probably taken a season or two. whereas in this, like, at this point, they were like, well, okay, the whole point of this is that she's immediately going to respect him, immediately get the sense that there's more to this than meets the eye, what he's doing, in terms of, she was obviously supposed to go down there and go, well, it's all a load of crap, it's all nonsense. The paranormal doesn't exist. There is nothing. There is no aliens. And then by the end of this episode, she's gone, okay, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I can't substantiate it, but I'm not going to like outright disavow it. But also it's that lovely thing where, and again, like, I'm not saying this is like realist drama, but it's able to encapsulate that, the messiness of life. So you've got these two characters that, yes, they could have been written in a way where it's just that they are the embodiments of their ideology. They're just the embodiments of their professional roles.
Mm.
But because we get that later scene where, Scully is in a state of distress and, you know, she needs reassurance. I mean, that's quite rare in itself. We didn't get a lot of kind of those particular scenes in the show. But, like, Mulder then, not in a kind of, like, predatory sexual way. You know, he is just as a friend, you know, consoles her and talks to her, but then he offers something of himself up to her. So this is this is where the connection's made. It's because they can't then go back to simply being, you know, I'm doing this job and I'm doing this job and we're meant to be at opposites. It's because the mess of their kind of like real life neurosis has been shared and stirred together. So they're almost like, they intrinsically now carry a bit of each other around with them because they were brave enough to share a bit of themselves, you know. And I think that's a really good, I mean, it's, and the writing there is much harder to sell, but I think that Duchovny really does well, you know, in this episode, but in others as well. A bit like, I remember Harrison Ford used to make that remark about having to deliver George Lucas's dialogue, that you just have to just throw it out there and hope it sticks. And
yeah,
I think Duchovny does a great job of that, because some of the stuff that he has to talk about is laughable in a way.
Yeah.
He really sells it in this, I think, you know, in that later scene with a lot of sincerity. And I really enjoyed the way that they did that. Again, it's a scene that I completely had almost forgotten that it had happened so early. But, you know, he told her obviously about his background and the disappearance of his sister, having had her, you know, in her bra and knickers, worried that she'd like going crazy had she been abducted. You know, I think it just plays really well. It could have just been really cheesy and fallen flat on its face. But I think, like you were saying about credit to the actors, they really sell it to you.
They do.
That gets you invested and that you care. And you think that these people care about each other. I think that's like the really crucial thing, that why I want to watch on is not just about finding out the aliens and whether any of this stuff could be real. I wanted to know where their friendship would go, not just about would they get together, but how would they move forward in a way. Even though they're meant to be enemies, they're clearly not going to be that.
I think that's a really nice way of putting it, definitely. I think it's very important. There's some very important scenes to their whole relationship in this episode, absolutely. And I think, you know, Scully's reaction to seeing the two marks on her lower back, and then that having, like you said, that completely non-sexualized, even though it could have easily been sexualized and would have been in a lot of other shows.
Yeah, they tease it, don't they? You think, oh, she's getting in the shower, and then, like, you know, she's like the damsel in distress, but it's not played like that. You know, she falls into his arms, but it's not in a sexualized way.
It's relief.
Reaction, yeah, his reaction is definitely not, oh, I'm going to take advantage of you.
No.
At all, you know, he's, I think, kind of, you know, shopped for her. And then, like I say, the fact that he repays that by, you know, entering her into his trust in the most kind of intimate ways is just really well done. Like, even just talking about it, I'm thinking, like, I'm really impressed that they managed to pull that off so well.
Well, it gets to the core of their characters, because obviously Scully was coming into this world with no, like, understanding or background of knowledge, you know, with the paranormal at all. You know, she's a complete new, like us, she's completely new to all this. She doesn't know what any of this means. So when she gets those marks on her back after looking into this case that she's very sceptical of, obviously, and, you know, with all the thing what Mulder's talking about, abductions and UFOs and all this, but then you would react like that. You would go, oh my God, what the hell is this? And that relief would be there. And his reaction, he sums up the character as well, because one of the things that Mulder is quickly established as is, to an extent, not asexual, but his brain doesn't seem to work in that way, and quite often. And that's
it's not his primary drive.
No.
As it is for so many of us.
Yeah, for most men it is. And, you know, there are... In certain scenes, you know, later in the show, there are jokes made about the fact that he never gets laid and things like that, and he's never interested in it. But yeah, it's not his driving motivation, and that's really refreshing. In fact, there was pressure on Chris Carter to obviously to do that and to stick to the traditional norms of relationships. He said at the very beginning, he said, a big part of my job during the scope of creating the pilot was protecting against that romance. He said, I was really the lone voice saying we cannot have these people romantically involved. And obviously, you know, we know eventually that does happen, but that was a long, long way into the future. And the whole core of the episode, of the show, is that these two are professionals, friends, and it's about that, like you say, that those two ideologies and the trust between them. Because Mulder didn't trust anybody before this. He didn't trust anyone. He was paranoid. He was, you know, there's numerous points later in the series where he says, you know, you saved me. You know, you kept me going to Scully.
Yeah, because he very much was on the thin end of the wedge to be completely alienated, Associated from within, like, his profession and not trusting others because, you know, and like Scully, she could have, you know, she even uttered his kind of nickname, you know, Spooky Mulder. I was expecting possibly to find some kind of unhinged or crazy guy.
Yeah.
So, that, you know, the fact that they cut through that and then it gives it that whole, the minority, like, as we're being sided with the underdogs against the kind of, like, faceless machine. Again, that's a very simple but very powerful emotive engagement for someone like, you know, where you want to side with the underdog, you want them to see them do well. So the fact they were able to kind of create their own little intimate kind of partnership with us alongside them, and then, you know, we're fully on their journey to see, you know, that's why it gets so frustrating that they keep losing all the evidence all the time.
Yeah. And that obviously happens a few times in this episode, like the scene where Mulder ends up finding, because obviously they, you know, they go to Bellflower, Oregon, and they start looking around and investigating what's going on with these school kids disappearing, and then they find a corpse in the coffin of a baseball player who died some time ago, and it looks like an alien corpse, an alien body.
Not the greatest effects were now, but quietly, you know, quite to the left of mainstream when you're watching it. You know, again, that's what I was saying earlier about it. Kind of it engaged my sort of adolescent interest and fascination with the more horrific elements. You know, that's the sort of thing I wasn't used to seeing every day. Watching telly at home, you know, with my mum. So that was, you know, I like that he did these kind of weird, almost like freakish things. And the whole later autopsy scene, again, that's so common now. But it was still kind of unusual, at least at that time. Because I think the last time I actually saw an autopsy scene that had any impression on me, I think, was going all the way back to 7. And that was just the way that had been shot and lit and framed. Mm. Whereas, like, again, watching this, I was thinking, yeah, this all looks so twee and quaint. But really groundbreaking for kind of primetime TV.
I think in a way as well, I mean, you know, you say the effects weren't particularly good with that body. In a way, I always think The X-Files is at its scariest in the first two or three seasons, personally. And I think part of the reason is that they didn't have a fat lot of money. And so some of the spooky things look a bit lo-fi. Yeah. And I kind of think that makes it creepier because there are times when they can't visually show too much. But you'll get something really quite grotesque or eerie. Like there's one episode I always remember. I think it might be season 2, or it might even be season 1. I'm not sure, but there's a scene with blood congealing in a bath, and it just appears out of nowhere. This blood, and it's got this really sort of creepy strain of music from Mark Snow, and it wouldn't have cost much to make, and it's not a big effect. I think it might be Shadows. We'll get to that. We'll see the episode. But it's just a really, really creeped me out, chills me, and I think. When that coffin is opened and you see the body of what Scully obviously claims is a chimpanzee or an orangutan, and Mulder says, it's an alien, then I was a bit, oh, God. And even looking at, whenever I see that now, whenever I, you know, like obviously I watch the pilot, it's still, ooh. And I think that's kind of a little bit of a good thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that those sorts of, the more kind of rubbery effects you can withstand now as a modern viewer and have more affection for than the kind of more digital. I mean, it wouldn't have been digital then, but, you know, like some of the lighting work that they do to represent, you know, the appearance of the aliens or, you know, the questionable appearance of the aliens in this show. That's the things that you do watch and it takes you out and you think, and there's a couple of other effect shots in other episodes that are coming up shortly in season 1 where it really can't help but look incredibly dated. But, you know, that is just the way of that technology, you know, certain effects just don't withstand the test of time, whereas the more practical ones, you know, because I imagine this is like a model, like a prosthetic model that they've made in some way, although it's not utterly, you know, nuanced and detailed, at least it serves its purpose. And you're right, it's still a shock. You know, I'd forgotten that that's what was going to be in there, because actually in this episode, I find myself far less interested in the whole, you know, potential of the alien abduction. I think that was, again, the thing I was alluding to about coming back to the show, whereas that might have been a really big pull for me in the past. It's less so now. It's much more about the kind of characterizations and I go into those rough edges. That's more interesting to me, that, you know, it makes you care about what the mystery is, because otherwise now, in having seen so many alien abduction stories, that those parts of the episodes, which is obviously a huge part of the X-Files, they can't help but having far less impact, I think. You know, like we did get to a stage where we were at a point where I think it was, you know, with the last Indiana Jones film, where everyone was like, oh no, please, we've had enough with the aliens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's something that has to be to bear in mind. One thing that I've just seen, just go tracking back slightly to the whole idea of romance and things like that. There was a planned boyfriend for Scully in this episode.
Oh, right. So she would have originally been attached, and then we guess what? At some point in time, that relationship would have
fizzled out. Yeah. That was the idea that there was a character called Ethan Minette who was originally written and cast, and I think the scenes were shot because originally the idea was to give Scully some element of a life, and I think it's the Jersey Devil in a few episodes where she does go on a date with somebody.
Well, yeah, that's what I was talking about, where some of it's quite heavy-handed, that we see scenes with her, but is it her sister? And her sister's got a family and kids, and she's like a guest at their kind of like birthday party or something
That's the Jersey Devil. It's not a sister, but that's a friend, and that's a Jersey Devil. That's it.
Kind of like now, when you watch that, you're like, oh, this is so on the nose in terms of its like representation of like the domestic woman and like the professional woman, and like it makes you wince in a way. But the intent at the time, because that was quite fertile ground, like new ground to kind of be mining. It was in service of her character and some of the sacrifices that she's had to make in order to get to where she had, kind of like professionally. But it's always difficult because it does verge on what's become a stereotypical kind of portrayal.
But it was great that Chris Carter managed to get that rid of that. You know, I mean, he obviously was looking at it and the shape of it and everything like that, and he realised even then that that's just not something that's needed. And it, as we'll talk about with the Jersey Devil when we get to that episode soon, it was very quickly realised that the whole idea of Scully having a life is not something that needs to be part of the show. In fact, you know, that's not a very good episode anyway, the Jersey Devil, but it's one of the things in that episode that really does sap the drama and sap the pacing, because it's just, we don't need it. That they don't have to have other lives, you know.
but it can be off screen. And again, like with Mulder, you understand that, yes, of course, he still does the normal things that everyone would be doing, but he has basically prioritised like his mission above all else, like above all other considerations. And obviously, Scully's not at that place, but she clearly would have had to have made massive sacrifices to do what she's done and distinguish herself so much. You know, it's the whole kind of Clarice Starling again. You know, they're not, in a way, they're fascinating characters because of their, not necessarily insecurities, but because some of the unsuccessful elements, you know, they haven't been able to appease or indulge all of their desires and interests as individuals, just like anyone of any gender isn't. But it's, you know, it's just more crystallised, I guess, what it was in the kind of Starling and Scully characterizations. It's that kind of conflict, isn't it? You know, she sometimes takes a step back and feels like she is getting too involved, but then she can't help but come back. I mean, even in the pilot, there was a little kind of exchange where I think she sort of made a remark that she wasn't going to be losing any sleep over this case or some kind of evidence. And then obviously we see her, you know, doing it precisely that, you know, like pouring over a laptop in the dead of night, and then we fade to black. So, you know, she's already becoming more involved and kind of like not able to compartmentalize everything as she previously had done. So I think that's almost like enough. We understand that there's that conflict going on. You don't need to have loads of time in the episodes, because these would have been made for hour blocks with obviously ads.
Yeah.
So they're only like 45 minute plus episodes.
Yeah, roughly between like 42 and 45 minutes roughly, or even slightly less sometimes. So yeah, they had to pack a lot in really. As the episode goes on and they keep investigating, another key element to this, obviously, you know, the pilot does scenes involving, you know, potential, you know, alien corpses, the big, like you say, the big alien abduction light, but there's also the time loss. And that's another really key iconic moment where Mulder gets out, and again it shows his character, where he gets out of the car and he draws the X in red on the ground, and Scully's looking at him as if to say what, and Mulder's just like, you know, this is who I am, this is what I do. This will be relevant later. And then obviously later on where they're driving down that road in the pouring rain, and this is one of my favorite, it might be my favorite moment from the pilot, because the sheer joy on Mulder when he loses time and he goes, yes, we lost 9 minutes, you know, and then, you know, he's like, we've lost time, we're abductees. He's so excited at the idea of actually being part of this, what he's investigating, what he's looking at.
Yeah, and that's like we've said before about the humor elements that he's got. yes, they could be a defense mechanism to kind of help with the trauma that he suffered as a youngster and like dictated the trajectory of his life. But it also gives so much more nuance to his character, because it would be incredibly hard, a bit of a grind, if he was like morose. You know, he's obviously got every reason to be morose and kind of, you know, depressive and obsessional about in a pessimistic way. But that would be a real tough watch, you know. And then it would be like that Scully would have to be like the comic relief form. And I think they integrate it far better with, you know, just showing in some respects Mulder is like an excited kid discovering, you know, he wants to believe. So any kind of any verification of that belief is obviously a huge epiphany for him. And
definitely,
you know, it's not just about dark forces at play. I think that's kind of key. What's happened to him has sent him on a path where he's open to, you know, obviously paranormal or occult or kind of like extra supernatural elements. But it's not that he thinks that it's all just like this bad conspiracy. It's all just this horrible thing that's happened. Yes, those things can, but he's still got an element of, you know, that kind of like, it's the whole Spielbergian awe and wonder, of what else could be out there.
Definitely. And that balance is, I think, what makes him such a likeable and interesting character, and what makes us want to follow him as well, you know. And I think that this episode does have both of those elements. You know, it's got the fact, you know, he's got a lot of witticism to him. He can see a joke in something, or he can see a humour in certain interactions. But then there are moments where, you know, you really feel what the pain going on. And we go back to the scene, which comes soon after this, actually, where they're in the motel room, which is beautifully then bookended in the very, very last, well, I say last, up until January, with the miniseries, but the last traditional episode of the show, The Truth, where they're in the motel room. And like you said, Mulder brings Scully into his trust about his sister. And that's another crucial bit of information, and also contextualizes his mission, in which he says there are people trying, and this is the conspiracy element, and there are people trying to restrict my access for information. And so in that scene, we not only get Mulder explaining the story of what happened to Samantha, his sister, when he was a boy, which like contextualizes his mission, but also the suggestion that there isn't just alien abductions going out there, but the government know about it and they're trying to cover it up and stop him. And that's huge.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the like underpinning themes, isn't it? The aliens are one aspect, but also that other layer of kind of mistrust of our, you know, governing bodies. And I guess in a way, going back, although I can't help but have sort of, I don't know, it's really difficult. So I'm not saying it doesn't work anymore, but I think it's just become so familiar and kind of like cliched, the whole kind of alien aspects of sci-fi. I can remember, but I mean, I remember I loved it at the time. I can remember being really fascinated by a film called Fire in the Sky, which again is all about kind of alien abduction and kind of very much in the X-Files mold in a way. But, you know, obviously with the world events and kind of like post 9/11, things like that, and the oversaturation of the sci-fi genre, I would imagine a new, because again, part of what you're hoping to achieve with this show is that not only will we go back and revisit the X-Files, but maybe people will discover the X-Files for the first time. And I think that although some of it might seem a bit hokey and a bit not relevant now, the whole mistrust, isn't it? The whole kind of like conspiracy or people withholding all of the facts to manipulate and control you, I think is clearly only ever going to become more resonant. I mean, the context of that anxiety in the world has changed a lot, obviously, with global media covered, you know, terrorist acts and things like that. But that whole kind of like mistrust and feeling that we're not necessarily always going in the right direction for the best interest of the many, but the few, is incredibly palpable, you know, for today's audience. What's great about the X-Files and other genre shows, I think, is that they're there, like that kind of subtextual resonance is there if you're interested in it. Like if that's the angle or the lens you want to see the show through, that you can. But it's also entertainment. You know, it is very much like popularist entertainment, although I don't necessarily think the X-Files started as that. I mean, and again, in my kind of view of it and where it kind of stacks up with other shows, because it isn't like my number one favourite, I always did have the X-Files slightly left of mainstream. Like it always seemed to be the sort of more, it's certainly like a more underground show. You know, I don't think it always had like respectability, put it that way.
It reached a point where it was mainstream and popular.
Oh yeah, of course, but Buffy and things like that, you know, they cross over, but I'm just thinking I don't remember it necessarily being like that to begin with. I think it was
it wasn't.
The fan base
yeah
was kind of almost crucial in that respect.
If the X-Files had started the way it did in this day and age, it would never have got past 6 episodes. It would have been cancelled, definitely, because it was a slow burner. You know, like a lot of the great TV shows of the past, they didn't find audiences immediately. They were slow burners. X-Files took a while. I mean, arguably the first season is a bit ropey in places as well. And, you know, that whole shows are expected to, right these days, go for it straight away and be good and click and make it.
There's something in every episode, isn't it? Even if it is just like a character line, or it's just a bit of progression of the dynamic between the two leads. There's always just enough to make it kind of like worth watching.
That's exactly what it is. And that's the great thing about The X-Files. And it is there in this pilot, which isn't a perfect episode by any means. You know, in many respects, I think Deep Throat, the second episode, is a better pilot almost, because it feels like an extension of the pilot, really. But I think in establishing who the characters are, what the overall idea of the show is, that it is this police procedural with the paranormal instead of a bank robber or a burglar or, you know, a murder, has that immediate sense of, you know, something different and something exciting. And with these two brilliantly drawn characters, beautifully acted characters right from the beginning as well, a good script that establishes everything, and, you know, effective direction, even if, like you say, you know, sometimes it's a bit ropey.
More, yeah, it's more perfunctory, the direction, isn't it? It is much, I mean, like a lot of TV.
So obviously the pilot ends with the mystery solved to an extent. Well, that's the beauty of The X-Files, in that the mystery is never really solved, but everything is dealt with, in that the characters, the students, they seem to be okay now, most of them, either whether they've been told to be quiet, or what the Billy Miles, who's the lad who comes back at the very end, and he seems to be back to normal, even though it's that creepy hypnotic, you know, regression scene where
he spells out that he has been abducted and, you know, almost been fed messages to act on the behalf of these aliens, but like that's all just swept under the carpet, and we're all just meant to go on with our lives as if like it's happening, and it doesn't matter that there's been fatalities.
Well, exactly, yeah. Oh, don't worry about it. Although, of course, Billy Miles does come back in a relatively major way much, much, much later on in the series towards the end. But yeah, it's more about establishing the whole idea that Mulder will always get so close to the truth, or so close to an element of the truth, and it will then be yanked back out from under him. And then, of course, we get that final iconic moment of the Smoking Man walking down the hall full of the Raiders Hall, full of all the objects, and putting the little
like a transmitter that's been in their nasal passages, and their noses, that they found from the gorilla corpse. All right, so that's the last bit of evidence that Scully almost knowingly hands over to people that she. I mean, I guess she goes in trusting them, doesn't she, in the first meeting at the start of the episode? But I don't know. There's like a slight feeling, not of apprehension, but I feel like she hands it over, it knowing that they're not going to act upon it.
Right,
like it's almost like going through the motions of just getting confirmation of what she already has discovered just on working on this first case, that their superiors are not necessarily there to aid them.
Well, there's that great line at the end where she has that element of, it's not like it was at the beginning, and she said, and Blevins says to her, well, what does Mulder think? And Scully simply says, Agent Mulder believes we are not alone. And that's in a way, you know, her saying, well, I'm on the train now with him, and it's not going to be quite as simple as me coming back and telling you everything that he believes, because I think that he's not what you've painted him to be, or what you want
exactly.
him to be.
Yeah, so they were on opposites, and she'd been positioned that way, but you're right, she's like almost not on the fence, but she's sort of saying, I've written the report. Yes, it's not saying that his claims are fiction and madness. Mm. These are the things that I did witness, and I'm going to write what I genuinely, you know, I'm going to give you a report of the facts as I saw them. And if I can't substantiate them, then I'll acknowledge that. But it doesn't mean I'm not going to write that. I mean, and that is a shift, isn't it, for her? Because in some of their discussions already, she was coming much more from the empirical scientist point of view of, you know, you start almost from the proof. Like, and if you don't have that, then you don't look any further.
Well, she, you know, they sent her in there so they could get, you know,
well, it closed down.
That's it. They sent her in there because they want to shut the X-Files down, but they need a reason. They need somebody to go in and say that this isn't valid. We're wasting money. We're wasting time. Reassign him somewhere else. You know, he can't do this anymore. But she goes in there, in fact, and says, and comes back defending him in that meeting, and says, you know, when Blevins says, we don't see any reason for this department to be valid, she says, well, real crimes were committed, and we solved them, and we gave an answer, even if it wasn't an answer we can prove, we gave an answer.
And no, we don't give you grounds to prosecute someone in the legal system in a law. Yeah, that's, you're right, that's key. That's because, like, they don't see any point in it because they don't get to wield you know, their sword of justice, and, you know, they don't get the check in the mail for, like, all the legal fees and all that. You're right. Whereas she's saying, but the fact is, yeah, crimes were still committed and they need to be followed up. And that's true.
Yes.
That's
very true. Just because we can't prosecute them or we can't exactly quantify who's responsible and why doesn't mean that they should just be forgotten and shouldn't be looked at all. And that's the whole, that's why the X-Files, ultimately, that goes back to the whole idea of what the department is, that's why Mulder digs these cases out that have been lying there for years, that people have just shunted into a folder, because there is more to them, you know, and that's the beauty of it. And that's her setting her stall out and saying, this isn't going to be as easy for you as you thought. And there's that little moment where, when she walks out of the office, she passes the smoking man and she looks at him, and he just carries on walking, like he hasn't noticed her, and he walks, but she just looks at him as if to say, who are you? What's this about? And that's, yeah, you know, and again, it's, they obviously had the idea that he represented something bigger and something more nefarious and mysterious if they didn't have a character exactly involved. And that's an interesting little thing that, like we said earlier, he just represents something beyond what we know.
And it gives it another kind of great sense of, like, import. So she's, like, becoming aware that not only is, like, Spooky Mulder this guy with a reputation for kind of, like, looking into these strange cases, but it's being aware that they can't just say no to him. So, like, obviously he's respected, because I think, again, you covered this in your character primer, we learn that he's actually, like, a brilliant member of the FBI.
Yeah.
He was, like, a rising star. So it isn't that he's incompetent and he's not of any importance and they can just kind of, like, to laugh him off.
No.
It's that they need to get followed. They need to build, like, an officious paperwork chain of, you know, bureaucratical chain of command so that they can kind of shut him down, because, you know, he is a force to be reckoned with. You know, they want him as an ally rather than as an enemy, like, stirring up trouble for them. And also her just being aware that there's this mysterious unspoken figure that was present at the start and at the end of the meetings. You know, they're clearly, what they're doing does matter, because somebody's taking, you know, someone, yeah, higher up, even then the people that she's been employed by, is taking an interest in what's going on.
This is it. And that's exactly what that representation is. And then we get that final scene, and that obviously has been bookended at the end of the finale, but we'll get to that when we get to that. But yeah, it's it just wraps up the whole thing neatly, really. So it's a strong beginning for the show, I think, and it sets everything out well.
I think so, yeah. And even if it's not the greatest sort of plot in the sense that they, you know, of the alien abductions or slash murders, if that kind of mystery of the first pilot, for me, what I love so much about the pilot is just some kind of, like, iconic shots. There's a shot of Scully where she looks at a projector that Duchovny, you know, Mulder's character, has shown her, and she looks so much like Jodie Foster,
yeah,
at that time. It is untrue, because obviously they look incredibly young in the pilot. That's another thing that really took me by surprise while watching it. It's just how young Gillian Anderson looks. But yeah, because she's, like, in the dark and her hair's got, like, a brown hue because of the lighting and the way her facial features are, honestly, you could compare it to a shot of Jodie Foster in Silence of the Lambs and they look so similar, it's uncanny. And also you get that shot of her in the forest where she, you know, has got her gun out and it's kind,
yeah,
of, like, approaching the light, and we get what I imagine is, like, a cliffhanger, like would have been a cliffhanger, like a mid-episode cliffhanger, yeah, for the ad break, where we suddenly think that she might be going to get abducted by the aliens. So it's a great sleight of hand, because whether you know it or not, for that moment, like her, you've believed in it. Like, you think, oh my God, she's going to get abducted. Like, whereas
exactly,
a minute began, this is ridiculous, I don't believe in alien abductions. But at the moment, you get caught up in it and you fear for her, but in a way that she's not a victim. That's what I love. I think she's definitely got that steeliness, and the fact, you know, it's her with the gun and it's not the Mulder just has to look after her all the time. But yeah, no, I've really enjoyed going back to it, and I think I got a lot more from the pilot than I expected, to be honest.
Well, that's great, and I hope the same is true of everyone who goes back and checks out the first episode. Definitely. Okay, our next section briefly is Do You Believe In? And today, given the topic, this is basically going to be a segment in which I ask each guest whether they believe in the topic that we're dealing with, well, Mulder and Scully are dealing with this week. So, Lee, my question to you is, do you believe in alien abduction?
we've touched upon it, haven't we?
Yeah.
Discussion. So I think probably if I go back to the time that I might have very first experienced this episode, I might have still entertained the notion that could potentially have happened or be like a feasible but unlikely thing. Whereas I don't know, I'm less convinced of that phenomenon now. Not because I wish to believe that they don't exist and that we're the only ones in the universe. It's not that. That's like an arrogant standpoint that I don't wish to take. It's just more, I guess, that whole conspiracy or that whole kind of urban legend is no longer on the kind of my horizons now. I think there's, like, sadly, a lot more really horrible things happening in the world that you can't help. You know, I'd have to look past some of the horrible realities that occur on a what seems to be, sadly, a more frequent basis to then get to that. So, yeah, I don't want to, like, unequivocally say no. I'd like to think that, I don't know what shape or form or historical example I would cite, but, like, I'd like to think that we haven't yet discovered everything that we need, that we are going to discover about, you know, our world and the galaxy and things like that. But I don't know if the idea that an alien would come and just pluck a random person out, I'm not sure that as a fiction works as much for me as it once did.
You know, this is obviously going off the fact that, you know, almost everything that they investigate over the nine series is based on something that people have claimed is real in the world, and a real paranormal experience or something like that.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes it more palatable, I guess, is like it almost doesn't matter whether in the cold light of day I believe the particular skew of paranormal activity that they're looking into. The fact is, more often than not, within the confines of the show, they make me invest in it, and they bring up the... There was this a writer and came up with the theory of, like, the fantastic, which is that beautiful thing that kind of, like, stories can do and mysteries can do, where they allow you to interpret it from both points of view simultaneously. So you can't unequivocally say, oh, it's A, definitely supernatural, or B, is completely not supernatural. It's that fine line where in moments you're genuinely unsure, and it could be, you know, it's something that could be true. And I think in the best episodes, they're able to kind of, like, move the viewer into that space where, for a moment, like we said in the pilot, all your kind of, like, rational rejection of the idea of alien abduction goes out the window, because in that moment you're with Scully and you're thinking, shit, is she going to be taken?
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? But I think if you look at the phenomenon objectively, I think it's, you know, there have been plenty of examples as to, you know, real people who've been abducted over the years. And they're easy to find online. You know, people like Betty and Barney Hill is one of the most famous ones from the early 60s. But really, I think if aliens were here and trying to abduct us and experiment on us, I think it would have been something that would have been reported a lot earlier in history properly. And I think it's something that really only cropped up in the last, like, 60, 70 years, more so in America as well. And I think it was probably a response to the whole idea of being taken away from your family and taken away from... You know, in a post-war world where everything was frightening, especially in the Cold War, I think it was probably more a sort of dreamlike response to the fear of someone taking you away from your family and hurting you. And I suspect a lot of the time it's not completely, and like you, I'm not saying I don't completely think there's something to it, but it just seems a little bit of a reach to suspect that aliens would come there just for that.
Yeah, and the randomness of it, or the perceived randomness of it, sadly, I think in my cynical, more adult mind, speaks to more of a underlining mission statement, in the sense that, like what you're saying about, if it's about the threat of being taken from your loved ones in the middle of the night and being hurt, or it's like the injection of fear that evokes, well, that is how certain, how can I put this? That's how certain unscrupulous and probably not even-handed governments rule their populace. You know,
well,
that's happened, you know, not on necessarily our continent, but I'm not saying it can't happen here, but, you know, you don't have to look too far afield in the world where that is a daily reality that happens to people. So unknown, unfamiliar external forces from your daily life intrude upon your private, you know, home, and you get taken away and you're not seeing it, you know, and that's a way of controlling, you know, people that could be unsympathetic to your political goals. So, like, the more I say like that, it's interesting, it's concentrated, or it's been reported so heavily in a certain government, but in a particular period in time, you know, that was, you could argue that having some level of instability so that your populace would be looking for reassurance might have been beneficial to your, you know, foreign policy.
Well, yeah, exactly. Who knows? Who knows what? Who knows when he's drawn up?
The truth is out there, they say.
He's out there indeed. Okay, finally then, before we wrap things up, it's time for the most fun part of the episode, which is going to be our X quiz, which is a few questions, not too many, on specifically on the episode in general each week. So this little quiz will be five questions on the pilot, and these are questions about things from inside the episode, and then a guess the quote. So I'll give you a quote from within the episode, and you've got to try and guess who said it. And if you can name the scene, even better. That'd be great.
I'm breaking out in a cold sweat.
So, probably a silly question, but are you ready? Okay, question one. What year are the Bellfleur class of students from, the graduation year?
Oh, God. Right. So, with the events of the episode are taking place in... God, I want to say it is like 93 or 92 when the date comes up. So... it's got to have been like a couple of years before that, so I'm going to say 89.
Oh, well done. Well done. Good guess, yeah, because the episode was filmed, I think it was 93, but I think it takes place in 1992. There is a bit of a discrepancy,
yes,
actually.
Right.
With this.
You're right, that's right. Because, and I'm just thinking about their ages, so they'd only have been out of, you know, education for a certain number of years, so that's why, yeah. I just guess. So I'm pleased with that. At least I've got one now.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well done. Okay, question two. Name Scully's thesis from her days at the FBI Academy.
Oh, no. There's something, a new interpretation, and it's like, is it Einstein, a new interpretation, like one of his theories? Oh. I mean, how close have I got to these?
I'll give you that. Oh, no, I'll give you that, because it's Einstein's twin paradox, a new interpretation. So right, okay. I think that's a fair answer.
Or half, that'd do.
which obviously Mulder mentions to Scully in that first meeting in the office. And he goes, oh,
yes,
I've read it.
Again, that's another moment of kind of like tension between the two, because he is almost stipulating that, you know, she's obviously got this sharp insight and intelligence, but she's only using it to kind of like debunk what people have risked their
right.
reputation saying is true, you know. So it's
exactly. Quite clever. That is interesting. You're going to get this one because you've already mentioned this a couple of times. But which film director does Mulder jokingly refer to himself as when knocking on Scully's door?
Yeah, Steven Spielberg. I love that because of her reaction. Like, we don't see him say it. We see just Gillian Anderson as Scully's reaction to him saying that through the door.
Yeah.
And the broad smile. Because I think that's another thing. Sometimes it'd be easy to say, oh, you know, when you've got characters like Clarice Starling or Dana Scully, that you know, I think a negative way of someone criticising them is that they would say they're really uptight and like stern and austere, whereas there's a real warmth, I think, from Gillian Anderson's performance. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just one of those moments.
I think that's absolutely true, yeah. And that's, again, another example of Mulder being dry, and also a direct, you know, nod to Spielberg, who and you know, Carter, as Chris Carter has said, that, you know, Close Encounters was another inspiration for this episode. So
definitely,
yeah. Question four: who did Mulder catch in 1988 when working with the violent crime section?
I'm not going to remember his name.
It's a tricky one.
Yeah. So I mean, I take it it's like some serial killer, and that's kind of like partly fed into why he was identified as a rising star in the academy, or in the bureau, I should say. So
yeah,
I'm not going to guess the name, I'm afraid.
Scully says it to Blevins. She says he helped catch Monty Props.
Yeah, I never would have
in 1990. I know, a bit tricky, but I had to throw one curveball in there. Okay, question five: name the psychiatrist who treated Mulder for regression hypnotherapy.
I feel like, yeah, there's people listening that they would have this immediately at the tip of their tongue. And it's just like highlighted my lack of familiarity with the subject material. But I'm enthusiastic and interested to learn. That's my defence, because I'm going to have to pass on this one as well.
Okay. Again, it's one of those things that you won't always guess. Dr. Heitz Werber. And he's the guy who is giving Billy Miles the regression hypnotherapy at the end.
Oh, right. Okay.
And
he
also crops up, I think it's season five, Patient X and The Red and the Black. And I think, and he appears again to counsel Mulder at a various point. So that's an interesting little thing.
By the end of all this, I'll know that.
No. Yeah, you'll know Dr. Heitzberger. Okay, and finally, the little quote. Now, again, like I said, if you can guess the person who says this and the scene, then you'll get 2 points. The quote is, "It's not my ward, not my aisle of the protus section."
A produce section, is that what she says? Yeah, so this is...
Produce section, yeah.
Yeah, because obviously she's making a very politically incorrect joke about the youngsters in her charge being vegetables or being in a vegetative state.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the, I'm going to say like the nurse, I guess, or the doctor, and she's looking after Billy, and there's another lady there, there's another young girl there, because it's in the scene where she's very shortly after has like a nosebleed, doesn't she, like a seizure?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well done, very good. Okay. And the reason that's just an unnamed nurse, but the reason that stuck with me is because it's an almost strange moment, because she's not a character in the episode, but she has this real sort of oddly sort of witty interaction with Mulder, and you see him laugh, and it just struck me as a little bit strange. Like, you know, she gets this really sort of witty but like sort of disparaging line toward. It just was a bit odd, and it just always stuck with me in the episode. But yeah, well guessed. You've done very well there, actually.
I've rescued it with the 2 points at the end.
Yeah, no, but you've got out of the 5 questions, you've got 3 of those right. So no, well done. Good knowledge.
I'm pleased with that. I've survived.
You did great. Yeah. Okay, that brings us to the end then of the first official look at the series with this episode of the X-Cast. Huge thanks, Lee, for coming on for this. It's been really fun talking about the pilot with you.
Yeah, pleasure. I'd say I really love what you're doing in the whole kind of like format of the show, and in particular your openness to get, you know, your potential listenership on to take part. I think that's a lovely way of doing it, and it just shows like your total one kind of pretension. You're just doing this purely because you've got a love for the show and you want to share that, you know, with as many of us as you can. So that kind of generosity, I couldn't resist, you know, wanting to be part of that. And I'm really, really looking forward to it. It's been great appearing on a show, and I hope to appear on others in the future. But probably even more than that, I'm just really keen to listen to your episodes as you put them out, and then, you know, and watch the kind of make my way through all of the shows as we go on. So it's going to be a very long engagement, isn't it? Like a number of years, but every success with it. I think it's a lovely idea, and it's, you know, in the good spirit of fun. And, you know, it's been a great opportunity. And I've been long wanting to obviously collaborate with you, because you having kind of discovered my own podcast, Movie Matters, and you've been kind enough to send through some very insightful commentary about, you know, some of the stuff we've discussed on there. So it's great to be able to talk to you live for the first time, so to speak.
That's really nice of you to say, Lee. Thank you. It's part of the joy of it for me is actually getting different fans on. And I'm going to be podcasting with a lot of people I've never spoken to before. And that's really exciting for me as well. So it's just really cool, and I'm just loving the idea of going back with my new Blu-rays and looking at the show again. So Movie Matters then, where can we find you and your podcast? Do you want to tell us a little bit about Movie Matters and where people can find it?
Yeah, certainly. So Movie Matters, or the Movie Matters podcast, is like my regular haunt for podcasting, although we don't have like a weekly schedule. It's very much kind of like a passion project of mine and Michael McKenzie, and we put it out as and when real life dictates we've got the opportunity to do so. But
yeah.
If anyone is interested and wants to hear us talk about like a wide range of films, not just mainstream movies, but a lot of kind of genre and more obscure titles as well, old and new, they can go to the moviematterspodcast.com website. So that's going to have, you know, our full archive of past shows, and we are on iTunes. But we have got, sadly, rather confusingly, we've got 2 feeds currently up on iTunes, because we've had a few issues with the one that we did use for like the last 5 years. And we've moved over to a new one, which sadly means we've lost a lot of our reviews. So if you do end up giving us a listen and you enjoy what you hear, do subscribe, please, on the new feed. And you'll know it's the new feed because it will have the more regular, more recent episodes, such as our recent Halloween Jalo triple bill, and obviously it will have going forward our Christmas special and a review of the year that we've just spoke about. But so as I say, I've been doing that with a good friend of mine, Michael McKenzie, and we've just very, very lifelong passion for film, and maybe some sort of areas of film that not necessarily a lot of people are aware of. So we specialize a lot on kind of like Italian genre cinema, but of course, you know, we just did a Bond double bill recently, so you know, when we cover whatever we feel like we've got an interest in, the listeners will want to hear, and we always want to hear from the listeners. We're always keen for them to send us like emails or mp3s and just get involved, really.
Brilliant. It is a really great podcast. It's really interesting. As Lee says, they cover some fascinating things, So yeah, please do check them out. It's a really, really great podcast. And the fact it's not out all the time makes it even more special when we do get it.
That's very kind. We're, a few listeners, loyal listeners, have said that to us. So that kind of gives us the motivation to keep going, because it is very difficult finding the time. And that's why, again, I've just got nothing but respect for the huge undertaking that you're signing yourself up for.
Well, we'll see if I manage it in the long run. But yeah, please do check Lee out. You can obviously find us on Twitter at @thex_cast. Please do drop us a tweet, send us a message. We're at thexfcast on gmail.com, I should say. Email us, let us know what you think. We are at www.beholemedia.com, which is the overall hosting network for the XCast, which is my overall network. So you can find our page there with the episodes. And, you know, do check us out over there. We've got some other podcasts over there which you might be interested in, to do with film. And we're also on Facebook at the XCast. So, yeah, just come and let us know what you think. It's really important for us to be engaging with the listeners, with the fans, especially the X-Files fans, you know, to just let us know that we're doing some interesting stuff. And if you've got any suggestions to things we could cover on the podcast, let me know. Let us know. It would your input will improve this massively and make this even more fun. So please do let us know what you think. And we're on iTunes, obviously. So like Lee's podcast, do leave us a 5-star review. Nothing less, please. but that'll help us get more known among the X-Files podcasts who are already out there, because we're joining one of another community, really. And we're also hosted on Acast as well. So do check those guys out, because they're the ones who help us publish. So do look them up. So thanks again, Lee.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tony. Been a real pleasure.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you. We'll be back for File 2, which will cover the second episode, Deep Throat, or the first episode to an extent, really. So we'll be back soon with that. But remember, until then, trust no one. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @thex_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening, and keep watching the skies.